forget the first moment when I walked in Cure Cinema. I was hooked from there on.
Hello and welcome to the 15th episode of the new and revived and improved Scanon Podcast, your source for weekly news, Irish film and international. I'm Darren, and joining me are...
Roman.
Nicola.
Daniel.
Jason.
Grace.
And so we'll start where we normally start, which is what we've watched this week. Now, because there are six of us here, we're probably going to keep it relatively brief, so about two films each you've seen since the last time that we talked. So, Roman, what have you seen in the past little while?
I haven't seen too much this week. There's been a lot on for me. But the one thing that I would be very enthusiastically talking about is A Taste of Honey, which I saw at the IFA. The Tony Richardson film, early 1961 British social realism. It was introduced by Will Stout Ledger as part of their bigger picture strand, bringing back, you know, figures in love of the community and bringing, getting them to show films that have been important to them or films that they think more people should see. And it was really, really great. I hadn't seen the film. I wasn't familiar with it before. It's really interesting. And in introducing it, Will Stout Ledger was talking about how Italian neorealism seemed more of an influence on it to him. And it's interesting the way it kind of weds that aesthetic that, you know, almost post-war paranoia with a strange optimism. It's a really odd film in tone in that it tells the story of a girl growing up in the north of England whose mother is sort of implied to be going around town with lots of men and has had this daughter with she doesn't know who her father is. But it's really interesting the way it plays out. She goes off and she gets pregnant herself and then sets up with this friend who's gradually revealed to be gay, and it creates a kind of strange image of a possible utopian society and then constantly falls back on the harsh realities of post-war Northern England. It's really strange and interesting, and I'm really, really impressed by the visuals of it. Great to see it on a very big screen. There's a lot of shots framed against the steelworks in the background. It's absolutely beautiful. And there is that clear neorealism influence and the jumping off point for a lot of British social realism, I think. And I'm really glad to see the IFI have another Tony Richardson film next month. So I'll definitely be going to that.
I haven't seen it actually, but I have seen a few of them. He's done a few there around that time. The kind of social realism with Albert Finney and stuff like that. Yeah. Tom Conti and like a long distance runner and... Saturday Night, Sunday Morning. Mm. Really, really good films.
Yeah,
it was really cracking era for a British one.
Yeah,
the kitchen sink drama kind of.
Yeah. Absolutely taken with it, and really, came away seriously impressed. And the other thing I'd flag is an Irish short film, Wave, which screened on RT on Monday night and is on the RT Player, I think, as part of their short screen program, which is really strange visually. There's all sorts of psychedelic stuff happening. The main character. Wakes up one day and speaks a language nobody understands, and due to various convoluted plot points starts huffing ether, and the film gives you a weird visualization of what that might be like. It goes down some
talking a strange language before huffing ether.
Well, maybe the ether makes it even stranger. It's really, really odd the way it plays around with the idea of the internet. It's set in the modern day, and this character gets somebody to film him speaking in this language, and it's broadcast out to the internet, and he just gets relentlessly mocked. Then one day he finds somebody who speaks the language too, and it's celebrated by the internet. And it's quite interesting the way it's handled. That, as far as I know, is available on the RT Player for a while, and while we're checking out, I would say the visuals really, really impressed me.
Cool.
Nicola?
And now for something completely different. on Monday, went to the Odeon screen I'm seeing, obviously, do mystery films. Except this week it was a Scream Unseen, so it was a horror. And I think there are a few of us here along about it if we want to talk about it. It was a sequel to The Strangers, not The Strangers. I was a bit disappointed to find out. And The Strangers is a 2006 horror film.
Oh, I've seen that.
Liv Tyler, and the guy from Always Sunny in Philadelphia.
It's fairly decent, if I remember.
It's great.
I don't know if we're that far, but
you won't go that far for this.
I saw the trailer for the sequel.
So it's called The Strangers, Pray at Night, semicolon. Yeah, there's a strangest colon
phrase. Not a sentence. It is an actual sentence, or like a descriptive phrase of what the brain and what the strangest do.
Yeah, so I suppose it's a kind of a it's a slasher. It's a cabin by the lake kind of horror film. Strange people appear. Strangers, would you believe? And it's. I didn't see the original. I have no idea if it's a great film.
It's not. It's good. It's very good. It's film. Decent. It's not. Don't listen.
It's
to
a very good.
It
film.
Is good.
It's one of the most underrated movies of the 2000s.
Darren hasn't seen Martyrs yet, so he does not know what he's talking about.
Well, I've seen I don't Martyrs, trust and I wouldn't. It's amazing.
So who do you trust in this scenario? Is what I'm asking.
I think we're all in this room.
So is it? It's. I think it's quite. Typical film. Like the truth is this one.
Yeah.
The truth is that, you know, there isn't much to it. Like it could be a bit more violent. It could be a bit more weird. Like I was surprised to discover that these were apparently the same people from the original film. Apparently.
Okay. I didn't get. I'm not a huge Strangers continuity buff. So I really wasn't that invested. I know that cold 2006 horror.
I don't see how it could be because it's 12 years later.
Yeah,
right?
I mean, one has to imagine that those masks, you know, kind of.
Yeah, the masks were the same, similar masks or something like that.
It's like a franchising.
And I suppose, you know, the thing about it is that it's fine. Like this is a perfectly fine slasher film. Like if you're just looking for something to throw on one evening, but. Would you necessarily be running to the cinemas to see it? Probably not.
I thought
some have
shite,
other opinions.
But,
yeah. Running from the cinemas, perhaps.
I saw it as well. I don't know. I think there's enough decent stuff happening in horror that we don't need to watch generic horror movies.
Well, this is kind of weirdly retro, and it's weirdly retro for a movie that's not very good.
But
it's like Friday the 13th Part 2, which is not a good film.
That's a weird pitch out, doesn't it?
It is, but I remember watching it and being surprised that it was set in the present day.
Yeah,
because it opens with the kids in America, playing on the stereo. The soundtrack includes Bonnie Tyler's "Total Eclipse of the Heart." You know, the gang at one point are quoting like Nirvana to taunt their victims. The title card is done in the style of The Exorcist, so I was expecting it to be like The Conjuring or The Conjuring 2, except but for slasher movies.
Mm.
And I was really surprised when people took out their phones and put earphones
in. Did they do that in It Follows as well?
What?
Something similar that it looked like it was older and then it kind of...
It looks like it's meant to be the 70s.
But that was carried through in It Follows.
Yeah.
And there's really nothing.
No
reason for it.
No,
not at all.
Aside from the soundtrack.
Yeah. Well, that's
a consistent soundtrack.
And the font.
And the idea...
which is part of the version.
Yes. Every good horror movie has a solid font. But I mean, it's a sense that they're trying to do Friday the 13th Part 2, but it's like... There are better movies to do.
Like, or it must be in the millions, like.
Yeah, I like Friday the 13th Part 2. It's not a good movie. It's not even a good slasher movie. It's reasonably adequate and kind of admirable in its grottiness. It's like, that's not a movie that you want to set as a template for a sequel, a belated 12-year-later sequel to one of the most underrated horror movies of the 2000s. Shut up, Jay.
I'm used to hearing that, it's okay.
If it didn't cost much... And they're going to make some money out of it.
Yeah,
it's pretty much a hard template, though, isn't it? Like, if you bring it under 20 million, you're pretty much guaranteed proper money.
So, why not?
Yeah.
It's not that bad.
Yeah.
Daniel's
au contraire.
And then after that, not that night, in preparation for Avengers this week, I had a rewatch of Captain America Civil War, I want to say. Because I can't keep track of the titles and I can't keep track of which ones, what happened, where, when, why. I remember at the time I thought Civil War was... I really enjoyed it. I love Captain America. He's my favourite character out of all of them. Like, I think he's a good guy. And I remember hearing someone in the office complaining about him once saying that he's not very interesting. It's like, but he's a good guy. Like, that's
the worst. Well, does that not mean something?
Why can't we like a good guy? Like, you know, like Tony Stark is kind of a dick. I mean,
yeah,
why should we like him? Like, you know?
I'm with you. I like Captain America.
Like, he's great. So, I remember thinking that there was a lot going on in this too. There was a bit too many people, but I enjoyed how it moved the story along and this kind of piece. Apparently, I forgot that Black Panther features significantly in it because I was obviously having seen Black Panther and going back and watching this, I was like, oh, he's everywhere. Like, you know, he's all over this movie. Like, how did I miss him? But yeah, great film. Like, definitely, I think, worth a watch before Avengers, a nice precursor. Obviously, it's there on Netflix for anyone to pick up, and most of them are.
Most of them are. Netflix.
I'd love to watch all of them, but
all 19 of them,
because
yeah.
I'm lost. To be perfectly honest,
you're probably okay.
I was half tempted to try and do one a day, but then I was like, you would have had to start 2 months ago. No, that's only if I decide to mix in like Shield and Daredevil and stuff like that on top.
You would. Wouldn't you?
I like to be thorough, Ronan.
But only half of them are. Good, right?
Yeah,
like,
I think so.
Are above
About to say, like, I'd say somewhere in the range of 80% of them are average, 10% of them are below.
I do think though, if you're
and
rewatching,
10% are high.
You could most people, sure. I would imagine, could ditch 46 without.
Oh no! You could ditch about 15 of them.
Just watch
the Captain America.
If you were plopping them down in front of me, I'd probably rewatch about 5 of them, and that's anything else. No thanks.
I ranked my own sort of list of them, and I was like, "Yeah, I'll take the top five,
mm-hmm.
are, like really rewatchable, and the rest good."
Do you want to do your top five?
Which five?
Because
I've got till
10 a.m.
Saturday. So
it's a podcast extra.
At number 5, Black Panther. At number 4 is Iron Man 3.
I love Iron Man 3.
At number 3, Thor Ragnarok.
Okay.
At number 2, the most shocking entry on this list, Thor.
Original Thor.
No. Yeah. It's the best Superman movie in 30 years. That's a low bar to clear, but it flies over it. And at number 1, Guardians of the Galaxy, the original.
Seriously, no Assemble? No Avengers Assemble?
That's 6.
That's the best
Captain
film.
America. Captain America.
We'll have some conversation. I didn't want to be
him being a nice guy just isn't enough for Darren.
I think that's going to be a cola or something. It's going to be cold here, right?
Okay. Having killed the conversation dead. Daniel.
I also saw Strangers Pray at Night, and I thought that it was crap, and you shouldn't. I saw it for £5, and it was €5 too much. So, don't go see that. And I was bored on Netflix, and I thought I would rewatch The Nice Guys, random connection to Iron Man 3, which I was disappointed with when I saw it in cinemas. I think because Kiss Kiss Bang Bang and Iron Man 3 were just such high points for me for his filmography. But a rewatch, it's great fun. It's a bit long, but they're just Russell Crowe and
Ryan Gosling
just work perfectly together. For me, I don't know. The chemistry is perfect. The lines are all there. The stupid action stuff that Jane Black had help doing is there as well. And the poor damsel in distress who gets shot in the head. Everyone's seen the film? It's too late now.
If you are listening to this podcast and haven't seen the movie, you have now.
I thought it was great. It was just really what I wanted to watch. And I think it's a real shame that Jane Black disappeared for almost 20 years. But I'm very happy that he's back.
Yeah. That's a major leap up, so, from being disappointed to
well, I think just because the bar was so high, or it felt like the bar was very high, and I think it was fun the first time around, but
The Nice Guys is such a good movie that even Jay can't hate Ryan Gosling.
No, it's not such a good movie. That's not a reason.
We were talking about this not 15 minutes ago. Talking about how much we had both hated it.
Okay.
So no, it's interesting to see that window.
I feel like this might pick on Nicola and Daniel.
I just thought it's so dull.
I really liked it.
I quite like Gosling in it.
I actually think, it's probably very, very fine performances, and they have a great chemistry, but it felt like they had nothing to do.
With Daniel in it, so I'm going to raise my hand.
I really
liked it.
That was fun for me. Now I look forward to Predator, even though who knows what that's going to be like.
It has Jacob Tremblay in it.
What?
Why?
Protect him?
There we go.
He'll die first.
Of course. He's the adorable quippy kid who's obligatory.
He'll either die first or he'll be the Predator.
Yeah, that's the punchline. That's the twist. The guy takes off his mask and it's Jacob Tremblay.
I'll show you it in the trailer and then you won't need to bother seeing it.
Alright. So Jay.
Jay, you're up.
Yes. Okay. Yeah. I watched the last kind of one I hadn't seen of Lynn Ramsey, I watched Ratcatcher, which is her debut. And it's kind of, I don't know if anybody's seen it.
I haven't.
It's incredible. It's a film set in, in Glasgow in the kind of early 70s. And it's this kind of transition between the kind of emptying of tenements into council houses and kind of setting this kind of really grim kind of tenement. And it's like there's some sort of bin spikes or there's refuse everywhere, like in black bags, and so the kids are kind of bored and wandering around the whole place, and it's grim, kind of gloomy kind of stuff going on. There's a it's like a child dies in the first like 10 minutes of the film. Like, it kind of sets its thought pretty early that, you know, this isn't like, this isn't your nostalgia driven childhood, this is the kind of the real deal, that kind of, you know, kind of fear in the pit of the stomach kind of childhood thing. So it gets on from there. It cheers up a slightly, but not a huge amount. But it has this weird kind of dark kind of palette, kind of. But then there's this scene where the kid kind of hops on the bus and goes out to the last stop, which is where the kind of houses of the future are being built. And they're built right beside a kind of a wheat field. So you see, there's this scene where the camera follows and the music kicks in, which is, you don't really hear earlier on the film. He kind of climbs through a window of this house that, like, it's only half built. Like, he urinates in the toilet. You know, the toilet's not connected to anything just because it's there, you know. It's that kind of stuff. So he hops through the window and goes through the field, and the camera follows him. It almost looks like a shot from The Searchers, you know, as that kind of coming through the window. And it's like this kind of brief bloom of happiness before it kind of goes away again. But it's a weird kind of hybrid of Dennis Potter, Terrence Davis, and even kind of Fritz Lang doing M when he did M, that kind of city stacked kind of feel to it. And like, it's absolutely beautiful, like, and perhaps her best film.
Whoa.
Which is I wouldn't go that far. That it's a debut, and how confident and assured and how much tone is kind of held perfectly, pitched really beautifully, like. And the cast, which I imagine some of them are certainly not professional actors, which she's done in various films, are to the, like, perfect and just pitched beautifully, like, particularly the kids. And, like, there's no kind of sense of that, oh, geez, childhood was great, wasn't it? Mm-hmm. Like, it's presented here as a horror show, like a real horror show of unrelenting, just escape it so you can go to be an adult and score the pub for 50 years until you die, you know, that kind of mistake, and forget it. It's that kind of
you can graduate to the kind of parties you go to in Morven Calvary.
Exactly that. But it's sensational. Like, like all in Rancid Guns, I think, bar when you talk Kevin, it's like 90 minutes long. So it's, you know, she doesn't mess around, she doesn't waste a frame.
I really need to catch up with that.
You do, it's great. And the other one I'll mention is, which I watched yesterday because I wanted something kind of that I enjoyed but didn't want to demand me too much because it's slightly hungover. So I watched About a Boy, which is
Nicholas Hornby.
I really liked this film when I saw it years back. It's really
another one of those. You're going through like a bit of the origin of late stage Hugh Grant at the moment, having watched
Bring Me the Diary. Also, he's amazing.
He is
like,
great.
You know, he's great. Like, yeah. I mean, yeah, it's more of the, like, after watching Paddington,
that's
like,
what I
like, it's
his
story. It's like, but this is kind of in the beginnings of that kind of late Grant movement towards that.
When he was just mid to late Grant.
But like, it's really well done. It's a great adaptation. The casting of Nicholas Holt and Grant and Rachel Weisz and Toni Collette, all really, really seasoned pros, like, very, very good. The Badly Drawn Boy soundtrack is aces, like. And it's just, it really works well. The script is really well put together and the film is really well put together. And it just has that kind of nice get in, get out, narrow 40 minutes, really well made, enjoyable film, and, you know, none the worse for it. Like, very well done and very entertaining.
Cool. Grace?
Well, at the weekend, I finally watched The Big Sick, which I enjoyed. Thought it was quite good. Took a while to warm up, like a long time to warm up, and I was not, this may be a terrible thing to say, but I was not a big fan of the character of Emily, so I didn't really care that much about what was going to happen to her.
But
it was amusing,
nevertheless. So little character.
She's complaining for a while and then she's gone.
It's all about him, which is really disappointing.
Complaining for a while about her boyfriend keeping his secret, you know, arranged marriage pact with his parents is a legitimate complaint.
That's a legitimate complaint.
I feel like if you're telling her to back off on that. Sorry.
I don't know, I didn't really see what the big deal was myself, but clearly we have different perspectives in relationships.
I kind of agreed that it almost doesn't establish that relationship well enough for you to buy into the whole drama of it, especially considering haven't they just broken up before it all happens?
And then, kind of. They've had some weird argument Anyway, like, it was grand. I did really enjoy it and I thought it was quite funny. I just felt like it took a while to get going.
I think about 20 minutes after I'd watched it, I'd largely forgotten the whole thing. Like, it seemed okay when I was watching it. And like, and now if you're trying to ask me plot points, I'm like,
it
was okay.
Yeah, really like the parents though. I thought they were
great. They were great.
And what else did I see? I saw A Quiet Place last night, but I've already seen that, so it doesn't count. Oh, Ghost Stories. I saw Ghost Stories last week, finally, which was, also grand. Thought the ending was ridiculous. Didn't really enjoy that. But parts of it were legitimately quite spooky, and I enjoyed it for the most part.
Cool.
So two just okay movies.
Perfectly adequate.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah.
Cool. I watched a bunch of films, but films that we haven't talked about, I haven't covered yet. I watched The Last Jedi with the score-only version that's been released by Rian Johnson, using John Williams' score.
Oh,
it basically constructing what?
Oh no.
What?
I hate this retro. Like, it's a sound film. Stop pretending it's a silent film.
Okay, I actually, to be honest, you
not
are.
Not you!
Me personally. It's like, shut up, Darren. But no, I okay, fair point. I accept your observation. But I also think that you're highly unlikely to ever get a $250 million silent film released into cinemas.
Hang on, let me ask you a question. Sorry, score. It's just score only as in what?
As in no soundtrack, no dialogue, no subtitles.
No. Just the music.
Just the
they're
music.
They're just moving their mouths and nothing.
They're
is
just moving.
Wait,
their
what?
Mouths. They're moving the mouths. The John Williams score is playing.
Fuck,
would anybody watch that?
To be honest, it might.
Well,
let's
tell
it.
Let's
it might
tell
radically
us.
Improve the Last Jedi.
Okay.
If you can't
sorry,
hear anything
oh, yeah.
that's happening in it, and you just have to look at it. You could make up your own story.
All right.
Sorry, there's the goofy side of the day, Robbie.
We'll chat about it later.
We'll talk about it later. But no, I think it actually works quite well. It is very close to a silent film aesthetic. Grace is actually correct in that it does iron over some of the dialogue problems that exist, in that it avoids a lot of the jokes around, say, hooks or whatever, or some of the banter or whatever.
Oh,
but
the entire character is expository dialogue.
It also helps with the physical comedy aspect. So hooks getting thrown on the ground, hooks getting knocked around, works a lot better when it's just a soundtrack thing because it looks like a silent film. So it has that exaggerated physical quality. It also demonstrates that Johnson is arguably the best director from a technical standpoint ever to work on the franchise. In that
it's not a high bar.
What?
It's not really a high bar.
Okay, fine.
It's not.
It's like directing the best Superman movie in the past 30 years. But yeah, it's not the highest bar, but he's able to communicate very well through blocking, through staging, through positioning the camera, the relationships between characters, the point where you don't really need dialogue.
He's a director, right? Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, it is one of the most, it is the most visually beautiful film in the franchise, despite all its problems, which are myriad. But yeah, so I was actually quite impressed in watching it in that respect. Mm. Other one that I watched, which is interesting, is Forrest Gump.
Mm. Oh.
Which I have very strange and conflicted feelings on. Part of me absolutely hates it, in that it's this saccharine, very conservative, very sort of pre, like, 1994 Republican Revolution sort of glimpse of American culture, where it's like, weren't the 60s a horrible mistake? And wasn't it terrible when people were sexually liberated and protesting Vietnam and taking drugs? And wasn't it great when they all got AIDS in the 80s? While, you know, pure, silent, stone-hearted Americans who were decent and fought in the war and entrusted in the markets to lead them to glory, they persevered overall. There's an element of that to it.
There's more than an element of that to it.
But there's also something a little wry and subversive in the idea that the personification of the American century, the first half of the American century, is this sort of almost idiotic, sort of this naive and innocent person who's blundering through history, completely unaware of the impact that he has, trying to make sense of a universe that is chaotic and random. It's kind of interesting as a historical artifact in terms of, like, it encapsulates, I think, how America experienced the 90s, where it was trying to make sense of this turbulent 50 years leading back from the end of the Second World War to figure out what the hell happened, how things got the way they are, and coming up with an answer that amounts to a shrug of the shoulders and a feather blowing on a breeze, because there's no greater cultural context or meaning that they can assign to it. Mm-hmm. And it is a fascinating cultural artifact. It argues in many ways for the great man theory of history. And maybe this is the great man theory of film. Maybe it's not a good film, but it can still be a great film, if that makes sense. Mm.
I'm with you on that interesting idea about what it says about, you know, the winds that are guiding where history goes. And it's really interesting, the dialogue it sets up between fate and chance, I think, throughout the whole film. You get in the image of the feather and all sorts of other things going on with it. It's an interesting thing underlying, and I think it has more going on than people give it credit for. It doesn't mean I like it very much.
No,
I agree with you there. Yeah.
I'm kind of conflicted between, because I admire it on a technical level. I think it's very wry. It's also achingly sincere, and it's very hard to properly process how much it's on one side of the aisle or the other, which is probably part of the key to its success.
I've never had the desire to revisit. I saw it when it came out. Absolutely deplored it. and maybe it was a politics thing with it, and I don't know if I see more in it now if I rewatch it. I just really, just the thought of having to sit down and watch it.
It is very much a the '60s were a mistake.
I don't remember that. That's what stuck with me more than anything else. Like, and yeah, poor Robin Wright.
I
may do it at some point, but just I'm not ready yet. It's only been 24 years already.
We'll get you there, Jay. With counselling, we think we can make it.
Yeah, you never know.
All right, so let's talk about the week in film news. The Audi Dublin International Film Festival came to an end this week. 7 weeks, I believe, after it began.
And 3 days before the next year's one started.
Yeah, with the screening of The Delinquent Season, which is actually releasing in cinemas this Friday. So we'll probably talk about the film a bit when we get to the discussions of the films that are being released this week. But interesting enough, The Breadwinner won the Audience Award, which is great.
Hmm.
The animated,
the one that's still not released.
The one that's still, well, okay, in Ireland.
It's coming out in May. Yeah.
It's coming out.
It's
in
on
May.
Netflix in the US.
It's on Netflix in the US. It's also perfectly possible to purchase it perfectly legally.
Yeah,
okay.
I'll just get angrier and angrier.
It is a very strange release schedule that they have.
But it's fine film though.
It's a beautiful film. It's really, really nice. I thought. No.
It's grand. I mean, yeah. I don't know. Cartoon selling stuff has never really landed with me. For whatever reason, and this I thought was slightly more coherent because it actually had a bit of a story. But yeah, I don't know. I thought it was decent, and I think it's a nice story to be out there. I just thought it could have had a little more going on. It was certainly nice to look at, and I'm sure Irish audiences will come out and watch it. But obviously, they already know that audiences like it, which is a nice thing to go into.
I hope audiences come out to watch it. I'm not so sure, but we'll see.
Yeah.
In terms of Irish film, Principal Photography is beginning next month on Calm with Horses, starring Barry Keoghan, which is the first film being developed with the RAP funding out in Galway, which is very cool. That's one to watch, I think. It also stars Niamh Algar from The Drummer and the Keeper, alongside English singer, songwriter, musician and actor Cosmo Jarvis, who may have been seen in Lady Macbeth.
I don't remember him in it, but I don't know what he looks like. So. I did like Lady Macbeth, though. I'm not sure who he played, though.
Cool.
That's the main thing.
Yeah. The important thing is that he's accomplished.
Good old Cosmo.
Good old Cosmo.
Who was he?
Okay, hold on.
Come on, Darren.
There weren't that many characters.
Was he the husband?
Yeah,
or was he the
husband? He was so amazing.
I'm guessing he's dead.
Well, Lady Macbeth was last year, wasn't it? If I remember correctly.
It's all right.
He was Sebastian. And that makes no difference. Yeah, everybody is really glad to hear that. It's the sexy, trunculent estate worker.
Trunculent.
That's a word, isn't it?
Yeah. That's from the Guardian review.
So he was a major player.
Yeah.
Okay.
And he's a musician or something?
I believe so.
Jack of all trades, by the sounds of things.
Yeah.
And trunculent. Don't forget that.
Don't forget trunculent.
Trunculent jack of all trades.
That's probably the jack of all trades I found.
All right, with that in mind, then we'll move on to talking about the top 10.
Ooh.
Always the most crowd pleasing and sort of general warm feeling that we get in the room when we talk about the top 10. Interesting.
Yeah, animated movies that made the top 10
that nobody's actually seen. But interesting enough, actually, quiet week this week. Very few new entries, and in fact, one I believe returning friend.
Yeah.
Really.
Yes.
Yeah.
This is the greatest show.
By the way, can we celebrate the fact that we actually have two people on the podcast who have seen the greatest show?
Excellent.
They're doing sing-along screening sound stuff, apparently.
We should go wrong.
It's still on.
But that's,
let's go to a sing-along screening. It's about time. I'm up for it.
But this is the...
In 48.
This is the Jay Cinema of Experience. This is what
stop
we're doing.
It. No, stop.
Myself and Jay have agreed to do basically immersive cinema experiences.
I've been bullied by Darren into doing this.
4DX.
I'm
the Avengers in 4DX.
Yes, I'm curious about it, but...
Do you want to take my place? Do you want to give me money?
But, yeah, so
go straight in.
I just feel like it's going to hurt my back.
Me too. I'm not 20 anymore.
You're just not with it anymore.
I'm not down with the kids.
Did see that short one once and they stabbed you in the back.
That seems a bit of a character. One of those theme park
Disney
ones
theme
that
park.
Oh,
are
yeah.
experiences. But yeah, one of them is supposed to kind of stab you in the back. It went right.
Like a spear kind of flying at you or something and actually stabs you.
That seems overkill.
Yeah, somehow I don't think Cineworld's 4DX quite has the stab in the back plan.
I don't know, because the video I saw, it looks like the rocking looks quite aggressive. I don't know. I'm very
just
old,
sitting there going, pew, 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 pew.
that.
You have 3 hours of that coming up, Jay.
Yeah. 2 hours and 29 minutes. But anyway, so The Greatest Showman is back in the list. So
yes, still great soundtrack, still worth watching.
2.5 million earned so far, which is remarkable for a film that was considered dead on arrival when it opened opposite The Last Jedi.
It actually opened up to Forrest Gump 24 years ago.
The Last Jedi has now released a new version of it. Yeah. All the time that it's been.
Yeah, The Last Jedi is now out on DVD, and this is still in cinemas.
Remarkable. So.
I like a decent musical, and this is a decent musical. It's okay, who cares that the story doesn't make any sense, and actually was a real rotter in real life. And it's kind of an arsehole in the movie, so they don't really gloss over it too much. But yeah, the dance sequences are nice, it looks well, the cast is having fun, and the songs are decent.
The songs are great.
I thought I would be the moderate person, and then you would say,
yourself. I've listened to the soundtrack. I haven't seen the film, but I felt the least I could do was listen to the soundtrack. And
you see every film. How is this been 3 months and you haven't seen it?
Just watch the film. Jesus, not that long.
Come on, darling.
All right, then. So, number 9, Ready Player One.
I saw that after everybody else, I think.
Yeah, possibly.
Not after me, because I haven't
seen it. I liked it.
I actually quite liked it as well. I mean, I don't know the books. It's a book.
Yeah.
I don't know the book at
all. It's not a very deep book. I don't
get all the references, but I found it entertaining.
But it has the Spielberg-y sort of like young idealist kids versus cynical adults. And Ben Mendelsohn is a great cynical adult.
That's true, he is.
I liked it.
Perfect.
So it's good.
At number 8, Duck Duck Goose.
What?
No.
You've been missing a few weeks, Grace.
This has been in the podcast, in the list.
We have talked this out, Grace.
What's it on now? Can you
it's now at number 8. It's now up at 550,000 euro.
We're in the wrong business.
Go see it, so we'll have somebody in the podcast.
That's actually seen this. At number 7, the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society.
Whoever decided to release that with that title deserves to be shot.
No, it's a great title because you remember it. You're like that potato.
Yeah, you
peel
remember
movie.
It. The 1,200 word long title.
It's longer
everyone
than the book
calls
on which
it's
based.
Guernsey, I'm sure.
I haven't read the book, but it's one of my sister's favorite books apparently, and she went to see the film and she said it was a delightful adaptation.
What did you think?
I thought the film was dull. But kind of okay. I get sort of genial enough company.
It looks like a BBC tea time drama.
It has like a weird plot, which is like something dark and secretive happened on this island, but then you keep uncovering it. The secret is how awesome these people are.
I was thinking was in the film is actually from their finest.
Yeah, which is a much better World
much
War II
film.
So
apparently a good adaptation. I don't understand Lily James, the appeal of that person.
I really like Lily James.
Well, she just doesn't really have... Well, she doesn't have any character in this. I mean, I think that's
something that afflicts her in a lot of things.
She needs a better agent.
She clearly needs a better agent.
Yes. So I don't know, did you enjoy it?
I did not care for it.
That view must have hated it. I know, Darren.
It's the mildest I've ever heard you about anything.
No, it is, like, it's inoffensive. Yeah. It's, like, clinically inoffensive. It's, like,
clinically inoffensive sounds horrendous.
It's been sort of sterilized. Anything resembling a sharp edge has been corked before it's been given to you. It's anemic. There's no blood in it. It's just pale and pasty and there. I'm sorry.
It's about potato peel pies.
This makes much like potato peel pies. No, it's grand and the cast are good and it's hits all the beats that you expect a film like this to hit. Mm. And it's just you're longing for something, something there.
The sweet relief of death.
No, it's not that.
Oh, okay.
Or at least a small explosion. Something.
We'll talk about one of those when we get to the new releases.
Or we get further into the top 10.
Jay's getting contentious. At number 6, and I'm curious if this is the one, Jay, Love, Simon.
It is not, I haven't seen it.
Is that up on last week?
Not, I think it's around the same place.
It's pretty impressive. It's holding well, isn't it?
Yeah, which is great.
I suppose not entirely unsurprising, because, again, very underserved audience.
And a charming film.
Yeah, absolutely. Good word of mouth on it. It's good to see you doing well.
And number 5, also holding remarkably well, Blockers.
Didn't catch it.
charming, the most charming film about butt chugging that you will ever see.
Please stop saying that.
Not to this again.
I can't do this again for another week.
Okay, fine.
For love of God.
At number four, Peter Rabbit.
Still there. Yeah, we talked about it the last time we were on. We were talking about Peter Rabbit.
It's over 3 million now.
It will earn more than Black Panther. Which is
this
remarkable.
Country is broken.
What race?
And it's a better Duck Duck Goose.
It's James Corden.
It's actually not bad.
It's not bad.
Yeah.
Does he die in it?
He's not there.
Tell me he dies in it, I'll go.
You can't see it. Like,
I'll still take his character. I'll take
I like how the table is literally divided into the cynical half.
I don't know what you mean.
I'm in the cynical half. Oh dear.
Number three, Truth or Dare. Blumhouse's Truth or Dare.
Yeah.
From the studio that brought you Get Out. Because that's the ringing endorsement. It's like from the producers of these movies that you liked, suggesting that we have no other talent of any skill working on this film.
Ultra distributors are becoming a thing, though. Between them and A24, like saying from studio
that
brought
you. A24 is serving up a certain
Blumhouse is so well known.
Yeah. Cool. At number two, Rampage.
You love
Rampage. I do not love Rampage.
You sound very enthusiastic. Week on week, Darren.
There are parts of Rampage that I adore.
Look,
and
I'll watch it the weekend and I'll come back next week and I can't wait to see Rampage.
It's incredible. Like, when it works on the earnestness that The Rock feels for his best friend, who is like a 1,000-pound albino gorilla. Who has been transformed into a giant monster. When he says, I just want to know what happened to my friend, you believe it. He really sells it. There's a really tender sweetness there. There's also, unfortunately, a lot of the city destruction that you associate with Man of Steel or Godzilla from 2014. Mm-hmm. So there's a bit of a tonal imbalance there. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting mess. And at number one, A Quiet Place.
Yay!
Which is not what this place is about to be.
No.
I saw this last night, so the hottest of hot takes. It's not very good.
It's great.
It's not.
There is no
very
hope
good.
For you.
There is not.
I'm with you on this one. I didn't like it very much at all.
I loved it. I really loved it. It's one of my favorite films of this year.
Does anyone do scores? Would anyone do scores out of five around the table?
I'd give it a generous two.
Ooh.
Ooh.
I give it four.
Four.
Yeah, I came in around two as well.
Maybe two and a half to call me a good thing.
I'd say four, even maybe four and a half.
I like the idea. I think the idea is ingenious. I think it's a really nice setup and idea.
Mm-hmm.
I think the score absolutely destroys it.
Yep.
It's absolutely unnecessary.
It does have a lot of the jump noises.
Yeah, it's tired tropes and a really unnecessary score actually undermine everything.
But it's like leanly constructed. It's 20 minutes of setup and 70 minutes of climax, which is astoundingly well. It's a really good wind-up.
Except that
the opening sequence still is a hell of a gut punch. Even when you've seen it.
That's probably about the highlight of the film for me.
The highlight of the film is that it's well done. I feel like
I think it's not very well done. I really didn't think Krasinski was particularly interesting in his direction. The kind of high point for me is when he constantly focuses his camera on, or not the high point of the negativity. The point for me that kind of hit it home that he doesn't really have a great visual sensibility is the constant close-ups on Melissa Simmons' face, who's an incredible actress.
She's the best thing in the film by far.
And any time the camera focuses on her face, you get the soundtrack tunes out, and you get her
their experience.
You get her oral experience, but the camera is focused on her, and there's a strange disconnect between perspectives. It's like we're looking at her, but getting her perspective in the ears, and the film never sort of really shows from her perspective. It's only ever looking at her. And getting her.
I mean, I don't feel like that's a terrible flaw in a genre piece. I mean, if you were constructing,
it makes it not especially interesting because you know we get the shot of the thing sneaking up on her and it's a little bit tense, but you never really get her perspective and see what the world is like for her. I think, and it never uses that, and it begins to seem like a device.
The issue, though, is if you can't film that sequence where she's menaced from her perspective, because the tension is the audience knowing and her not knowing because she can't hear it.
Yeah, but it's
you can still do it better, I think. Though.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Just to say. And I think, the other thing, not to bring it back to Bloody Nolan again, but... sorry, no.
The N-word is for...
There's a thing, right? We've had a discussion before where you get quite annoyed about people picking plot point holes in The Dark Knight Rises and stuff like that.
I don't get quite annoyed because they don't exist.
Oh, well, okay.
You see, but anyway, right?
Oh, that's not.
I think there's probably, I don't understand how your brain works. There's probably literally plot holes in nearly all films, right?
Oh,
something, right?
Yeah.
But I think how successfully films embed them into stories and how much interest you have in films leads you, I think, and Dark Knight Rises is a perfect example of kind of you spend your time after a while and wonder, oh, how did that happen?
Yeah.
And I was watching this film last night, and at one point during the film, I thought, how is that noise any noisier than the noise that brought them there? When this is clearly about as noisy as the other
running
thing.
Running through cornfields, slapping leaves.
Like, the logistics, I start thinking about the logistics, and you've lost me in the film when I start thinking about the logistics.
Yeah.
And it's, and if you can't bury that kind of stuff in a better film, I think that's where your problem lies.
Didn't we just have a joyous discussion a couple of weeks ago about the mechanics that It Follows?
Yeah, which I had major problems with.
Okay, fine.
But like, but you know what I'm getting at? Like, I mean, I, if people are happy enough to go on and it works for them, that's great, but it just didn't work for me.
And I think that's the thing, I acknowledge that I'm very much in the minority here. People,
yeah, me too.
People,
but I'm used to
by and large, seem to be really enjoying it, and that's fine. But from my perspective, it indulges fully in what really bothers me about most mainstream horror, which is just that the only scares ever come from this
really?
Quiet bang thing.
Yeah.
And it really emphasizes that with the whole conceit is let's be really quiet
and
then
and
really bang.
Noise, yeah.
But there's no sense of legitimate threat or menace that
I've never I've never been scared of
I
me
mean,
at all.
I,
yeah,
I
had no,
but the idea of being a pregnant woman in that situation scared the shit out of me, so I
don't
like
agree
with
that. But then I can now I read the headline right, I didn't read it because I hadn't seen the film a couple weeks ago where and I thought there's a reason for that. I was going to read, but I knew I was going to see the film, so I didn't want to kind of spoil it. But the headline was, it was to do, is A Quiet Place a pro-life movie? And there was this thing, it was an American article, right? And right, I meant to go back and read it last night after seeing the film, which I didn't get a chance to.
Yeah.
But after watching it, I can, while I don't necessarily agree, I can see why, where they're coming from to some degree. It's like,
okay,
you know what we should do? Let's produce something that will make the most noise that can be made and kill us all.
Mm-hmm. It's a plot mechanic.
This feels like there might be a kind of conservatism to it.
Some really, really odd takes. You got
I haven't read the film, but it's just interesting to me
that I will concede there's a conservatism to it in terms of it's very much about a version of America that feels unheard or unable to speak or unable to articulate itself, right? But what I would say, first of all, in terms of the jump scares, is it's a movie about sound fundamentally.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's a movie fundamentally about that noise.
Yeah, but
so
do
I feel
it
like
better. But Darren, it's not just, it's the tropes that we use. It's the third tropes that we use. It's the same horror stuff, just done in a different setting.
Okay.
For me.
Like, I mean,
I kind of liked the smaller scale approach to things, like the way you only really see from this family's perspective. And it's not really about, like, the creepy surroundings and the monsters. It's about them and the, like, trauma that they've been through and how they're trying to deal with it all in their different ways. And I don't know, I just thought the character work in it was really good.
I thought the kids were great.
And
yeah, really just, thing for me.
I got really wrapped up in the grief aspect of it,
mm-hmm.
I think. I thought it was a very good exploration of that.
Cool.
So I didn't really care too much about it.
So most people like it.
I am very, very used to being on the other end of these. It's kind of...
But don't worry, I'm sure we're going to segue into something completely uncontroversial now.
Oh, God.
The new releases for the week in question. Now, what we're going to do is we're going to keep the big ones to last, because
right.
we have some people in the room who don't want to discuss those films.
Anything bigger?
I don't think there's anything bigger than that this week. There's a bunch of small releases, like The Delinquents. There's a couple of films that premiered at ADIF this year.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, The Delinquent Season is out just 2 days after closing ADIF, which is...
Should have just gone.
Okay, am I the only person who's seen this?
I guess. Well,
yes.
They didn't screen it, ADIF, so...
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Also, I saw the trailer and it looks painfully
terrible.
Oh, I saw
the trailer
terrible,
and that was...
So I don't feel the need to...
Yeah, the trailer
It looks like a really bad orgy drama.
Yeah.
It's very stagey.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing you don't get much in Irish film and...
maybe for good reason.
Marco Rowe is like one of the great Irish
mm-hmm.
stage writers. He's obviously written movies before he wrote Intermission. He did Perry's Bounty, which I know Jay hates, for example.
Oh, that's got a dreadful film. That's a dreadful film.
It's a dreadful film.
Okay.
It's a waste of like a couple of million quid, that was.
Okay.
It's a height of the recession.
All right.
Yeah.
But Rowe is one of the
Sorry.
Great writers, if not
he's a writer.
In a descriptive way, not a qualitative way. But anyway, he's directing The Delinquent Season. It's the first film he's directed, and it's very stagey. In fact, he does this thing repeatedly throughout where he fades to black after key scenes, which mimics the idea of being on a stage and dimming the lights so you can change the sets, except you don't need to do that in films. You can just cut from one scene to the next. It's full of, it's overextended, it's full of characters who row, and I know having like seen some of his plays, he's provocative, he likes this idea of characters who you don't necessarily like. Mm. The issue is that they're not particularly interesting in the way that they're unlikable. Mm. In particular, some of the dialogue that Oro writes is terrible. Some of the scenarios are very forced. I mean, there are some interesting ideas there. There's like, it's good to see an Irish sort of kitchen sink sort of interpersonal drama play out. Just wish it were better. If that makes sense.
And it seems pretty much across the board. I haven't heard anything positive about it.
No, well, RT like it, okay. For example, and Entertainment.ie like it. So there are reviews. There are
once
four stars.
It'll be on RT at some point. Then.
They're getting it in there. It's like on 3-4 TV.
I don't
like,
it's a night movie.
I don't think that's quite how the paying for a movie airing on RT works. But,
it just reminded me of this tweet I read once. Of somebody sarcastically saying that, you know, if you're the type of person who likes reading genre books. But you forget that the only legitimate form of fiction is middle class rape people very slowly getting a divorce.
That's actually pretty much exactly what
when I saw that trailer. This is like the film version of one of those books that just you'd rather cut your eyes.
There is one Northsider character, and it's not a particularly nuanced portrayal. It's right. Slightly more nuanced than Damo and Ivor, but only slightly.
I talked to you earlier. I said the trailer reminded me of Carnage, the Polanski film.
Carnage is a much better film.
And I despise Carnage. I'm not the target. I thought it was dreadful. But so I'm not going to see it. I'm not going to see it.
Also. This week, then, and also having premiered at 8, is Beast.
Mm.
Mm-hmm.
Which is.
This looks okay.
It's Michael Pearce's star. Is it his first film, I believe?
Yeah, we saw it. Was someone over? He was there, very charming. Sorry, it was so long ago. But somehow only just ended. I really liked this piece. I suppose it starts out quite mysterious and it manages to sustain that piece of mystery, that kind of...
That's very tense.
Yeah, that tension throughout the whole film, which I thought was... Which is rare, actually, and it works really well here. I mean, ultimately, though, it's still quite a small film and, you know, I wouldn't necessarily, you know, for all the positivities around the genre and what it does in there, I find it a little bit hard to recommend.
I think it could have been a little bit tighter. It runs to an hour and 50 minutes. I think you could cut maybe 10, 15 off it and you have a much tighter package. But it's a directorial debut. The central performances are great, in particular Jessie Buckley as well. She's phenomenal.
Yeah.
It's really, really good and well worth seeking out. There is one more film we're going to discuss. I think Nicola and Daniel have asked... Do you want to? But I mean, just in case, before you leave, guys, if people are looking for a bit more Nicola and Dan in their lives, where can they find you?
I'm on Twitter at Amateur Film Reviews, AVG Film Reviews. I'm around.
If you look.
I'm around the streets too, yeah.
I'm on Twitter at LetterMonkey. I don't tweet much though, so, you
know. Perfect.
You can tweet at me.
Cheers. Thanks for having us.
Cheers.
The other big release of the week is Infinity War, Avengers Infinity War.
I've never heard this. What's this?
It's a low-budget indie film.
It's a new Lynn Ramsey.
It's an existential drama about people grappling with mortality, age, and the toll
and the
that time takes upon us. And the beast, the big green beast that we all have inside us.
It's been a very long 10 years.
Has it? And that's just this particular podcast.
Yeah.
It's out this week. It's the biggest film possibly of the year. It's going to be a phenomenon. Its pre-sales have outpaced those of Black Panther. It's getting relatively good reviews. Twitter is literally exploding at the moment. There's a whole host of discussion about what you can and can't say about it, which is interesting. There's a wonderfully weird culture of like spoiler phobia that seems to have crept up around the film to the point where, having attended the press screening, I was issued with a badge telling me that Thanos demands my silence. This is a press screening.
Yeah, that's lame.
It is.
They spent all the budget in the movie then, didn't they?
And the badges. Don't neglect the badges. But it's interesting because there's a really strange...
I do think it's a little excessive. I mean, I can understand why some people don't want to know anything going into a movie, but like that's like mute-ish, unfollow people.
Yeah.
Just don't go onto
Twitter
for a couple of days.
Yeah. But it's absolutely part of Marvel's marketing that it's like, create this whole culture.
Yeah.
Something amazing happens. You have to go and don't let anyone tell you what it is.
Mm-hmm.
This is an event movie.
Yeah. Oh, undoubtedly.
People will probably lose the rag if anything is ruined for them. So.
It's absolutely massive in terms of scale. It's basically A PG-13 and completely bloodless version of Game of Thrones set within the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And you can tell that from the point of view of having the Russo brothers as directors, because they are primarily TV directors. It's a lot of television, long-form plotting, maneuvering characters, splitting up your cast, breaking them up into smaller bunches, spreading them across a large geographical area, and bringing them together for the climax. Structurally, it's the best argument for the Marvel Cinematic Universe as television that you pay for to see in the cinema, with new episodes released once every 4 months. Now, that's not necessarily a good thing or a bad thing, it's just an aspect of what it is, I think. I thought it was grand.
That's a thumbs down.
Not the best season finale.
Not the best season finale. I mean, to be fair, you could argue that it's like the X-Files. The best things happening on the show are the weird, quirky standalones where, you know, Thor gets thrown into an 80s sort of Devo cover. Or, you know, Black Panther invents, you know, a whole fictional African culture from scratch. This is very safe, very bland. I talked about like the Guernsey Potato Peel Society movie having filed off all the rough edges. This does something similar without getting too spoiled.
How much can you do with such a massive cast of characters, though? Like, you can't really delve into that much substance with any of them.
Well, the issue is the sameness of tone that exists across most of the Marvel movies. So you have a situation here where to pick a number of examples, right? So, because it's largely a movie that throws together characters and watches the interactions. Some of them are charming, because the cast are charming. Like, the actors are very charming, debonair. But you have a situation, like, for example, you've got a scene with Peter Parker, Star-Lord from Guardians of the Galaxy and Iron Man together, and all they do is quip at each other for a solid 5 minutes. Yeah. And then the exposition happens, and most of it happens off-screen. You have another situation where, for example, Thor, played by Chris Hemsworth, goes off with a talking raccoon, played by Bradley Cooper. This should be amazing. You've got a Norse god of thunder, a talking raccoon, traveling through space to reignite the heart of a dying star, but somehow it just feels like another day at the office. There's something very generic about it. There's something very... The tone is so carefully maintained that nothing seems to shake it. And that's disappointing, because like the best part of Thor Ragnarok was the fact that you had a Norse god of thunder landing in a Flash Gordon movie, and you had this wonderful clash of contrasts where Jeff Goldblum was playing a synthesizer. And I mean, there's nothing as delightful or gonzo as that in this, despite talking raccoons and, like, you know, trees that play video games and, like, giant purple goateed omnicidal maniacs. You know, it's much more generic than it really should be. When you think of all the elements going into play, it's like every conceivable issue that somebody might have, anything resembling a controversial storytelling decision that might possibly upset fans watching, has been removed. There's, like, for example, there's a possibility of a character conflict existing between, say, Stephen Strange and Tony Stark over a really minor storytelling detail where Stephen Strange says, look, if this happens, I'm going to do X. And Tony Stark says, no, if this happens, I'm going to do Y. Then the thing happens, and they're like, oh, we should actually do W. Let's not fight about it. And there's no sense of character. There's no sense of, like, perspective. No sense of these characters being anything more than blank slates who occasionally offer witty one-liners. And they're good one-liners. They're really great one-liners. I chuckle a little bit. But it just...
There is an air of, like, something being sanitized about it. Because I was wondering about this recently, how... I wasn't, like, I really love the Marvel movies, like, I don't know, I just have a very deep affection for them, but I didn't feel myself getting particularly excited about this, even though I knew it was a big deal, and I am looking forward to it in one sense, but there's not the same sense of anticipation that I would have had for some of the previous films in the MCU, and I couldn't tell how much of that was down to maybe just thinking, oh, well, I'm sure it's just going to be, like, another standard experience, like, there's not going to be anything groundbreaking in it. Or if it was a bit of the old superhero fatigue.
Maybe it's a mix
of the two.
I don't think,
like, we're so used to kind of event movies coming out now, and I suppose with Star Wars in the past few years as well, you have this sense of, like, something is a big deal, and you're just sort of being hammered over the head with big deals constantly, and now it doesn't feel like a big deal, even if it sort of is meant to be.
Especially with Black Panther, the MCU just had one.
Yeah.
And it felt quite
different. And,
yeah,
you know,
yeah,
like,
that had the real kind of sense of, oh, this is something different.
Yeah.
And, whereas this feels a lot more calculated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, well, that's it. I mean, I would argue even that, like, Thor Ragnarok, a superhero movie directed by Taika Waititi, felt more exciting.
But isn't that the problem, perhaps, then? Is directorial choices, because
yes.
Russo's are
okay, but they're solid.
But the Russos are like second generation Marvel directors, so they're of the time that you got Whedon, they're the time that Marvel sat down with Patty Jenkins and said, no, we're going with Alan Taylor.
Yeah.
That's what gave you the Russos.
Well, see, that's the thing. Like, when you give them proper directors, the films are better.
Yeah.
I mean, it's... But, you know, it doesn't matter, does it? It's going to make a fortune anyway.
Yeah. No, no, it is. It's going to make the most money ever. All the money.
But the
argument, like, I mean, you have to give them some space to work with. Like, I mean, Ragnarok only works because they were allowed to murder Thor at a completely random, weird planet. Like, if they had written a different story, it's possible it would have just been another...
Well,
even with a solid director...
Well, the famous story about Ragnarok is that two things. First of all, Waititi said, I'm going to go film this in Australia. And they were like, what? And he's like, oh, don't worry. Like, if there's a problem, you can just edit the movie. So he went off, and he did what he wanted in Australia with minimum amount of supervision, came back, brought his cut. Marvel were like, no. Edited it, cut the hell out of it, removed, I think, 40 minutes from the version that we saw, screened it. It went down horribly with audiences. Waititi said, okay, let me put those 40 minutes back in, screen it for audiences. Audience were like, this is what we want.
Mm-hmm.
And so got to release it. I mean, yeah, I feel... And the weird thing is, like, I would much rather have a spectacular failure like Age of Ultron, which is a messy, ugly, completely all over the place, no thematic consistency.
I really wanted to rewatch that last night because I really didn't like it when I first saw it, but it has been taken off Netflix. I'm quite irritated.
But it wants to
see it again.
It wants to say something. Like, it wants to say something about, like, children and the future and reproductive and the things that we create and how they haunt us. And it doesn't say any of them particularly well, but it's trying to say them. Whereas the issue with Infinity War is Infinity War basically treats Thanos as the embodiment of entropy, decay, and time, but not as anything that affects regular human beings. It's only as it affects these intellectual properties. Infinity War's, like, big central metaphorical conceit is that, oh my god, the Marvel Cinematic Universe has to deal with the fact that these actors aren't going to be here forever, unlike their comic book counterparts. So let's have an existential crisis.
Well, but a better director, that could well have worked.
Oh, yeah.
A better script. Like,
yeah.
Is it, like, the idea is a sound one,
yeah.
If you can do something with it.
Yeah.
David Lynch would have been perfect.
Can you imagine Thanos directed by David Lynch?
Oh, good lord, I would kill to have that.
You know, it's going to make an absolute fortune.
No,
so we hand it over to somebody weird.
Yeah, just get them.
Which TV is because this is the film that introduces Thanos, and Thanos has been built up for how many years now? Like, it's so hard to make a villain like that that everybody's been waiting on have, like, impactful.
It's
you know, like, there's almost an argument to be made, and I would actually prefer if they had just made him look like a regular human, like just some random.
Yeah.
Well, like
Brolin
in Civil War, isn't it?
Yeah, but if you have just, like, somebody who's, like, the devil in disguise, but looks like an actual person, then that would have been a really jarring contrast between Randomer, who's also terrifyingly powerful, versus all of these big,
besuited
people.
Brolin's not bad in the role. There is some motion capture stuff, in particular, like, if you watch his hands when he grabs people by the neck.
And
it's very clear
sense. And
just a
certain level of weirdness for the CGI.
Can we stop with making Brolin a thing, though?
Oh, don't worry.
I'm sorry, no.
Really?
I can't get rid of him in pretty much anything.
In Hexplice.
Yeah, aside from that.
But don't worry,
sorry.
Jay. There's no other Marvel movie coming out this summer.
I saw,
I've
seen the trailer for that as well. It's like, I'm introduced to Josh Brolin.
Don't worry, in 2 weeks you're going to have another Josh Brolin Marvel superhero movie.
Really?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, Deadpool.
Deadpool, he's doing Cable. But, like, and the thing
that's
is...
weird.
Don't ask the questions. This doesn't matter.
They're inevitably going to fall together. So Disney's going to buy
it. This wonderful moment of Josh Brolin interacting with Josh Brolin.
There'll be Roald Dahl characters in the Marvel Universe. I would watch that. The twins wandering into
the giraffe and the Pelly and me and Thanos.
Matilda and Telekinetic.
Oh, yes.
It's ready to go.
The film does invest a lot of time and energy in Thanos, only to prove how awful, how much resentment the fucking writers have over the fact that Magneto and Doctor Doom were sold to Fox in the mid-90s. Because it is. It's literally like they basically say, why can't we have an anti-hero?
It's a good villain.
Yeah, it's like, so let's take this giant, like, swollen grapefruit.
They must have somebody else, though. There must be some, like, they've got billions of comics. There must be some guy there that's good.
He would be surprised. You would be surprised how many great villains belong to Spider-Man.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Can they not buy one off?
They
bought Spider-Man.
They have now, yeah.
Just get one. Get Dr. Doom back. Everybody loves Dr.
Get
Doom.
Get Tom Hardy as the villain in
Please,
Avengers.
Please, make Tom Hardy go away as well while we're at it.
Oh,
Jay.
You've got to be gone.
Yeah.
It's just awful.
That's Oh, Venom in 4DX.
Oh god, I saw 40 seconds of the trailer to turn off.
Brr, right? Tom Hardy doing Tom Hardy.
I saw
the Hardy
half
Hulk movie
tweet saying Tom Hardy.
That's it, yeah.
Get away.
Whoa, nothing is safe.
We got all out here.
The internet is coming for Jay and Ronan after this
hey,
podcast.
Bring it on.
Tom Hardy himself comes to my face.
Sorry, Tom, take your mask off. I can't hear what you're saying.
Hold on. Now,
properly,
be,
Tom.
To be fair, he's the guy who reads children's stories on CBBC over New Year's.
And oh, well, then I'll sit through interminable movies.
And he helps. And he rescues dogs.
I watched the CBBC.
Yeah. Did you hear the story about him rescuing a dog while he was filming in Prague?
It's PR stuff. He didn't do it.
Oh,
she kicked the dog into the river. Everybody.
Whoa. Okay.
It is in character.
I feel like this is an appropriate place to wind down the podcast.
I got more Tom Hardy stories. Sorry, Tom.
You're beyond saving.
All right, so Jay, if Tom Hardy is looking for you online, where can he find you?
I don't hide behind my masks. At Jay Kyle.
Whoa.
Sorry, I'm getting a bit delirious now.
Yeah, there's a lot of venom here. For
hey.
Are you going to be the bane of his existence?
Stop it.
I'm locking out of my Twitter.
Like every week for the past couple of weeks, we've been so close. And you just have to get one in.
That's what I do. So Ronan, if Tom Hardy decides that he's had enough of Jay, where can he find you?
I think he should just keep pummeling Jay, because I may hate Tom Hardy, but I am a little afraid of him. But other people can find me at Baron Ronan.
Perfect. And Grace, if Tom Hardy is looking for you for some reason, because this is the bit we're doing this week.
Is he looking for some reminding that he's a precious human who I adore? Then yes, he can find me at Pixie Grace.
You can follow me at Darren_Mooney.
We look forward to see who he comes for.
And we'll see you next week. Well,
bye.
Three of us, possibly. Bye.
Bye.
I'll never forget the first moment when I walked in Kyo Cinema. I was hooked from there on.